Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Why Didn't They Laugh, the podcast dedicated to analyzing why my jokes don't work and what I learned from the failure. Good times. And yes, it's only mine because I don't want to armchair criticize other people's comedy. Sometimes people will write to me and ask me why I don't analyze other people's comedy, and that I believe to be a dick move. I think that it's a highly personal quest. Comedy. If I looked at other people, I would be judgy. And it is not the type of field where judginess is cool because it's so, no one knows the answer. I've had conversations with people where they tell me what type of comedy is the best type. Or like, when people say there's rules of comedy, they're full of shit. Because I'll give you an example of a theater act monster career that broke any rule you can think of. And someone's like, oh, never use props. It's like, all right, tell that to Jeff Dunham or Carrot Top. It's like, oh, you shouldn't swear. It's like, tell that to Richard Pryor or Joe Rogan. It's like, oh, you should never be clean. It's like, tell that to Seinfeld. You know, it's like, there's no rule. Anyway, let's get down to business. I'm on the road a lot. Right now, I will be at the Hollywood Improv this Friday. Don't really care too much about making money on this one, so if you want tickets, just email me. I'll hook it up. I don't miss LA, but I miss the people very, very much in Los Angeles, so I'd love to see you guys out there. That would be fun. Just a nice night to hang out. Saturday, I'm doing the San Francisco Bay Area. You can get tickets at my website, hugepianist.com. I can't remember the name of the place. Next week, I'm doing the Syracuse Funny Bone, right near my hometown of Oswego, New York. The following week, I'm doing Plano, Texas. Week after, Orlando, Florida Improv. Week after, Dallas, Texas. Week after, Cleveland. And then I'm home for a while. Got to make that bread. You know, it's all about making that money for the winter, yo, so I can just hunker in. So me and my lady and my baby and my three dogs can just go underneath a blanket and just chillax. All right, so I'm going to play you guys a song. I wrote a song for the town I moved to, Saranac Lake. And I would love, I know it's a very specific song to the region. So I know it won't, some of you guys will have no idea what I'm talking about. But you'll still, I don't know, there may be some sort of enjoyment for you. I want help with it. So if any of you guys live in near Burlington or Lake Placid, or Albany, or Saratoga Springs, just the general Adirondack area. You know, I'm near Montreal. Write to me and let me know if you have any ideas about how to make fun of this area in a fun way, because I believe everyone deserves a ballad. I stand by that. So here's my ballad that I played at the Tour de Force. We did a benefit for the families of fallen police officers. It was a blast. Check out this ballad.
We moved to a town called Saranac Lake. In some lake flower, there's no Saranac Lake. In LA, the news is murder and fear, but not here. Front pages about a garbage eating bear. There's a village called Tupper Lake. It's on Rocket Pond. It's not on Lake Tupper. Can someone explain why Middle Saranac is higher than Upper? It's so confusing to me. Everyone here is named Dupree. If you don't vote for Rabideau, he'll still build you a house. But then Pat, the code enforcer, will kick you out because your house has a little tiny mouse. Saranac Lake has the coldest beers.
Oh my God.
Nobody tries because it'll freeze your tears. The weather is cold, but the people are warm. And everybody skis like Jason fucking Bourne. My brother will drop a tree But if you give him coffee, he'll talk about your flowers for 20 straight fucking hours. I don't remember ever going to the watering hole. But according to people, I've been many times to the watering hole. Saranac Lake is the only city in the country to say hey. Hey Walmart, fuck you. Nobody cries cause you have frozen tears. The weather is cold but the people are warm. And even little kids, they ski like Jason fucking Bourne.
Yeah, for example, the Dupree joke. You guys, if you're not in the area, none of that makes any sense. But just know that a lot of people here are named Dupree. And afterwards, one of the dudes was like, the health inspector really did shut down a house because of a mouse. He was dying laughing. And the cops had a blast. I got one of those cop stickers for the car. I've always wanted one of them. It's so exciting. I'm now in the crew. Because New York State Troopers are the best cops in the world, I think, personally. I've had run-ins with LA cops where I'm like, these guys are idiots. Some are great, but like, there's different levels of training. And I think there's different systems in place where some police units are just remarkably great human beings and just calm under pressure and very helpful. And then other police units are just like Shaggy and Scooby-Doo, just scared and trigger happy. So I am very happy to be in this region because when you see a cop here, you're like, oh, thank God. Whereas other cities, you see a cop and you're like, oh no. So this is good. But cops are definitely a group to be respected. And I stand by that. In the news, things can go south. But just remember, the news is a highlight reel of mistakes. Think of the thousands and thousands and thousands of interactions every day police have with very dangerous people that they do a great job with. And every now and then, things go south and no one wants them to. And I hope that there's major changes in training or technology or whatever needs to be done. But their job is extremely hard. Same with firefighters, first responders, great people. Okay, here's a joke that started bombing. And midway through, I realized why they didn't laugh. I didn't even have to analyze it on this podcast. And it's one of the few times I've really, really enjoyed a joke bombing. It really meant a lot. Check this out.
It's like the young hipster kids, like the millennial kids. I'm technically a millennial, but I'm like the oldest millennial, so I like kind of speak both languages. But you know the kids that like don't make eye contact ever? You know, and they're always like looking for a safe space. Like, I have PTSD because my dad didn't give me orange juice this morning. And I'm like, be stronger, man. He's like, aren't you tall? But they're weak. Not here. You guys, I love that you don't laugh at that because it means you don't have that. Normally when I do this joke in other cities, they're like, ah, you guys are like, dude, my kid fucking kills animals. That's why I came here. I was like, no, my kid's fucking building a 12-by right now. I'm doing it. What the fuck are you talking about? My kid didn't look at me. I fucking punched him in his face.
This week, we are proudly sponsored by Casper Mattresses. They sent me a mattress. It is awesome. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to customers. It eliminates commission-driven inflated prices. We all know those annoying commercials where the mattress people are super aggressive. You're not going to get that with Casper. You're just going to get a great mattress. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small, how did they do that, sized box. When I got my mattress, I literally said to myself, how did they do that? In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced customers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper has revolutionized the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. Mattresses can often cost well over $1,500, but at Casper, mattresses cost $500 for a twin-size mattress, $600 for a twin XL. That's the one I got. I got for the little man's room because I can sleep next to him when he's time for the crib. $850 for queen, $950 for king. The Casper mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foam to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Time Magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015, an award-winning mattress that won't disappoint. Free shipping and returns to US and Canada. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Of course, it's made right here in America. Try it for 100 nights, because you will sleep very well for 100 nights. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Owen. Use my name, O-W-E-N. That's the code. And you'll get $50 off an already very low price. This is a great opportunity. Sleep is extremely important. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Food, sleep, before you go to the next level. A lot of people are ignoring sleep. So your mattress may suck. Get a better one. And save $50 by supporting me, Owen. Casper.com/Owen. Much love. Yeah, and my dad and mom were at that show, and my brother did a 10 minutes up top. It's so funny. I'm helping him with trees, like we're cutting down trees together. And he's starting to do comedy. And it's not, and I'm not trying to be a tree guy for a living, and he's not trying to be a comedian. We're just kind of exploring each other's worlds, and it's so magically fun. It's been great. I'm just blessed to be here right now enjoying this. Just a wonderful time to be alive. I got to sit down with my dad recently and I recorded our conversation, and it was pretty magical because my dad and I were extremely close our whole life. Extremely close. He got me into the piano. The reason I got into piano is my dad sang opera, and I would go to opera rehearsals, and one day I was banging on the keys, just banging on them, and my dad was embarrassed. He was like, oh, I'm really sorry. He said to the conductor, Jim Saluri was the guy's name, he said, I'm sorry for my son. I'll figure out what we're doing, because I was two. And Jim Saluri said, but John, he's banging in the same key we're singing. And that, I guess, the way my dad tells the story, that's when they got me into piano, because I was just this little kid banging on the keys, but for some reason I was banging the right keys, or at least the keys that made sense, like my ear was good. So we're always very close. My dad is hysterically funny, and he's smart, and he's kind, and he's had an amazing life. And for the last, I'd say 10 full years, he's been fine, but he kind of lost his spark. And part of it, I think, had to do with some beta blocker shit that he was on. The doctors claim have no psychological effects, but ever since he's weaned himself down to as low of a dose as possible, he's back. And it's like we're laughing again. Like I get to see my mom laugh with him. You know, there was 10 years where there was like a bitterness to him. And a sadness that if you know my dad, it doesn't feel natural, because he's such a light. He's such like a positive force of energy. And it's so great to see him back. And I think the lesson that I've learned from that is just never give up on somebody. Like, not that he was still a great professor and he was still a great dad, and I'm not complaining, but there was just something missing from him that's back. And I don't know if it's, his brother died last year, and I think he's wrestled with some depressions, and I think he probably hit a fork in the road where he was like, fuck it, life is short, I'm not gonna waste any more time. And I just wanted to play for you guys a conversation we had. It ranges from my mom's three miscarriages and how my dad had to entertain my brother in the hospital, and then him going over to Hiroshima with his friend Tad, who was the mayor, and him teaching at Princeton and putting some kid in his place. It's really, he has really great stories. So I'm gonna play you some of that, and then I'll come back to say bye. After my dad's talk, I'll play you guys another little clip of the new Case Closed, Beers Open, because we will be putting that online sometime this week. And the new episode is pretty funny. So I'll just play you a little snippet of that. All right, much love. Here's my dad.
We went to the hospital. I couldn't leave him home alone. So I brought him along, and I had this tin of buttons. And I'm sure the doctors thought I was crazy, but I didn't care. So I said, Jason, find the pissy button. Oh, and he'd throw all these buttons around.
So what was the pissy button?
It was a little orange button, very distinctive, unlike any other button. And it was in the midst of all the other buttons.
Was it hard when Mom had her miscarriages?
Yes. Yeah. The most existential was the last one. It was 1970, spring of 79, and she had miscarried in the bathroom at home, so we called the ambulance. The guy came, they were all brought a stretcher up, was talking, and he said, you know, he said, if I weren't talking to you, I think you were dead. You don't have a pulse. Gene said, really? It was just such a strange thing for an EMT to say. He said, I cannot find a pulse on you.
Oh, she lost a lot of blood, huh?
Yeah.
So did you think I wasn't going to get conceived just because you had so many miscarriages?
Yeah. But then she figured out why. See, if you're heavy into nursing like she was, nursing is a natural way of spacing babies. So the lining of the uterus is very, very thin when you did all the nursing that your mother did. We didn't know that. So she could get pregnant, and then it would last 6 to 8 weeks, 10 weeks tops, and out it would come because there wasn't any heavy lining there. So she cut back on nursing of Jason, and poof, before you knew it, there was little O.
Yeah, so if she wasn't nursing so much, I wouldn't exist, because you would have had one of these other dickheads would have held on.
Yeah. One of these other dickheads.
What are some other good games you played with Jason and me when we were babies?
Oh, I used to tell stories about Hector the Oak Tree. I don't even remember any of them, and Jason, I think, does, and they were often born of desperation. My favorite was the story of the little boy who found the screw in his navel.
Oh, I remember that.
Your mother said, now, get them to sleep. They're real tired. So here you're all both cruising out. And he unscrewed the nail, and what do you think happened? I don't know, Papa. His ass fell off. Oh, yeah. Both of you laugh like hyenas.
I remember that. I laughed my ass off, literally.
Yeah, that was funny.
And then there was the Dance of the Green Peppers.
The Dance of the Green Peppers, yeah. And then Jason and I would play card games, though. I made them so confusing. But yet he followed him so seriously. I'd hand out the cards. Now, if you have the Jack of Spades, you win. Unless you have the Queen of Diamonds. then you don't win. You have to wait for me to give you some more cards. So I give him some more cards. Now, if you have the eight of clubs, you automatically win, unless the ace of spades is there. Then you lose everything. But should we deal some more cards? More cards, Papa!
You taught us about loopholes.
Well, yeah.
You're training us to be lobbyists.
Yeah. That was funny. How come I lose? I said, well, you got the jack of clubs. Oh! So, but then I'd hand, but now you have the eight of diamonds, which means you win everything. Yes! Oh, he was so pleased that he won.
Yeah, you always had the balls to do jokes anyway. What do you think made you not care what people thought?
I don't know. Because I always had a certain security. And I thought, well, it's hard to be fired. I knew the labor contract. I knew the public employees officers law in New York. So I thought, what? And I wasn't. I was never terribly interested in making a lot of friends. I don't have anywhere near the friends that you and Jason have. When Jason and I went shopping for something a year ago up here in Saranac Lake, every store we went into, oh, Mr. Smith, oh, Jason, or could just sit. And I think with your mother, why she had such a terrible time yesterday with blood sugar was everybody knew everybody. And yeah. They start talking and chatting.
It gets exhausting.
Yeah.
That's why sometimes I like being on the road as a comedian because no one really knows me. Mm-hmm. Like I can just walk around and no one comes up to me.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe every now and then someone will recognize me from comedy, but typically it's just I have these cities completely to myself. It gets lonely now that I have Amy and Walter. But there's something nice about it.
And every time I took a trip someplace, I'd buy a book for you or Jason, or both.
Yeah. That's cool.
I'd say, greetings from San Antonio, Texas, November 1979, because I was there for a conference.
Tell me about your buddy in Japan. Like, tell me about all that.
That is so strange. I have emailed him. I have sent him some really touching kinds of emails, and he's never responded. He's no longer the mayor. And see, Japanese culture is very different from our own. They made him distinguished professor of government administration at Chuba University, which is the Harvard of Japan. But that doesn't mean you teach there. It means they give you the title, they pay you a lot of money, and you can travel around and lecture and do whatever you want. And so I don't really know what he's doing. Last time I heard, he said, don't give up on me. So I said, okay, I won't. So I sent him a really beautiful email
But you guys were close, though, right?
Yeah.
That's an amazing friendship. You guys met when he was an exchange student?
Yeah, in high school. I said, Ted, you are like the guy with the lamp who's lighting the way down reform. But the frustrating thing is, if you went down that road, where would the light be?
Right. And did you go over there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was
2005. I spent a few days with you on the way home.
Yeah, that was in what? Oh, I'm so bad with stuff. He's the mayor of Hiroshima?
Yeah. Yeah. And then we were to see him his last year, March. Was it March 11th, 2011, Alu Kumar in physics, a good buddy of mine, he and I and about six kids were to go there for spring break, and the day before we were leaving, they had the earthquake and the radiation leaks from the nuke plants. I mean, imagine if it had been the day sooner, we would have been in the air during a major earthquake.
Wow.
And we couldn't have gotten to Hiroshima. And so
What was Hiroshima like? All called off. What was Hiroshima like when you were there?
Very beautiful place where I was. I was in the old part. Tad, I know, got me a discount at a hotel because everybody told me it is very expensive. For a week in a hotel, figure $3,000.
Jesus.
Well, it was $1,100.
Oh, yeah, you got
because
a discount.
Tad paid it. And he gave me certain things that I didn't use. He gave me this card. He said, this card will be good for any cab in Japan, any place. Don't take it to Tokyo, or I'll have a big bill that would be hundreds of dollars. But wherever you want to go in Hiroshima, just show the card.
That's cool that you guys just met when he was an exchange student in high school. What was he like back then?
Oh, bright, caring, smart, very athletic, thin, did track and field, tried to pick up on American sayings, and what he liked to do, I'd be Smith-type kid.
What up? Was he the fucky-fucky bird guy?
No, that was Ina Stegen. That was the German girl who was a foreign exchange student the year before. Ina Stegen from Heidelberg, I think. And so, she wanted to learn all these American ways. So I taught her about the little fucky, fucky bird. And we were in our speech class, and you're supposed to say something about your past and your future. So she talked about herself. But she said, I am really most interested in really meeting the Native American bird called the little fucky, fucky bird. And you know where it is, because when you're walking through the woods, you hear fucky, 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 fucky. And you know that's a little fucky, fucky bird. She had been in Elmwood Park about a week. Then
you
it was,
made that up.
Yeah.
It's good you got your sense of humor back, Dad. I missed you. I missed your humor. What do you think made you not like as giddy for like several years?
Well, I think the medication may have had something to do with it.
Because you're back to your like laughing, not giving a fuck self. It's not that you were like a bad guy or anything. It was just like you didn't have that like that giddiness, like that childlike character that you like had my whole life.
Yeah. I'd still go into the store and say, if I were a bottle of ketchup, where would I be? And the clerk would say, I don't know. I said, where's ketchup? They said, aisle 5. I said, well, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, that's where I would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started getting a little serious, I think, towards the end there in Los Angeles. That's why I'm glad I'm here. Mm-hmm. It's weird how, like, sometimes you can just, like, lose your, like, giddiness for life.
Well, and in 2012, 2011, Linda Reback died, and I never did get the details of that. She lived in Chatsworth. She lived in California. She was a good buddy I went to school with. I would visit her in California once or twice. I don't know where those pictures are. I have pictures of George Spalek and Linda Reback and I at Disney World in California.
Disneyland, yeah.
Land, yeah. Yeah.
I've never been to Disneyland or Disney World.
Well, but this was the mid-60s. It was fairly new.
I'm too
Linda
tall.
Linda lived in, when she lived with her family, she lived in Encino, California. She was a Northwestern student. That's where I met her, at Northwestern. Her father was chairman of the board of Continental Casualty of the Pacific, which at that time was a big insurance corporation.
Do you think it was easier to jump social classes back then? Because, I mean, your dad was he cleaned furnaces, and you got a scholarship to Northwestern, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is that as common now?
No,
it seems like
I
all these schools
know.
That are all into progressive bullshit, all their parents are elite CEOs.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see too many of these, like, working class people going to Princeton or Northwestern anymore, you know?
The Princeton and Northwestern, I think, both go out of their way to find them. I was a teaching assistant at Northwestern, had a young girl in one class and a young boy in the other class. Oh, they just feel so self-conscious. I said, Madeline, why are you so... She said, my father's a butcher in Kansas City. What am I doing in a place like this? I said, look, somebody in the admissions office said you are bringing something really good to this place.
Yeah.
And you are. So you don't... You should stay here.
You're a good guy, Dad.
Yeah.
And I feel like now, a lot of times, now it's not about economic, it's about race, and I find that disturbing.
Yeah.
We're like a rich... Like, Polynesian would have a higher chance than a poor white kid.
Yeah.
And I think economic diversity is more important than racial diversity. Because I think people of the same income level are have a lot more in common than people of the same race. I think people of the same height. I have more in common with tall black dudes than I do short white people. Mm. I don't know. Maybe my perspective's messed up. I'm definitely trying to learn more about this shit. But I just think that, like... I don't know. I just think that race is not as important as social class when it comes to giving someone a chance. Because there's, like, white people and Asians and Mexicans. And, like, a lot of Asians get fucked over more than anybody with this shit.
Did I ever tell you my story of Christopher at Princeton?
No.
It's my favorite story. Christopher, I forget his last name, his... Father, his grandfather had been governor of Florida. His father was some big shot. His mother was dean of the medical school at the University of Florida, Gainesville. They had all gone to Princeton, so he was there. And he was so obnoxious and condescending and smarmy. He said, why don't poor people just find a better job? Oh, I said, that's a great idea. Be sure to tell the Bushies. I said, yeah, that. I said, I'm sure people have thought of that before. And he was so awful. It gets better. The other kids in class did not like him. So last week, he gave his last speech, and people, he really was articulate and smart, but smarmy and kind of something. I said, Christopher, I want to tell you something. That I've been pleased to be your professor, and I'm telling you this out of kindness, professionalism, and caring. And it's an old saying I want you always to remember, and this is it. Where there's a will, you will be in it. He was stung. I said, and by that I mean... Everybody in this room, myself included, we live on very privileged perches. I'm not saying you should wear sackcloth and ashes, but I do think you need to develop a little more sympathy and compassion for people other than yourselves. And the class applauded.
Dad, that's genius.
And he wanted me to meet his parents. I did when they flew up for the ceremony. And he said, you know, he said, nobody ever talked to me like that. I said, yes, then I'm glad I did, because I didn't say that out of unkindness.
Yeah.
I didn't say that to mean that you're stupider. And I just mean developing compassion in this multicultural, diverse world will suit you very well.
Yeah, I've been called out for stuff and learned from it.
Yeah.
Like like the Black Panther thing. I thought that it was a terrorist group. We were raised to be taught that.
Yeah.
And then you learn, it's a complicated situation. They definitely use some tactics that I'm not a big fan of. But, like, when people call you out and you, like, actually put in the time to learn, you're like, oh, there's more to this story than I thought. And just, like, when you learn about just people, you know, because it's easy to think that a lot of these movements are... absurd when you live in Los Angeles or New York City, but then when you go to certain areas, you're like, oh, there's parts of this country that are fucked up.
So you like, where there's a will, you will be in it?
Oh, it's hysterical. Because that bootstraps bullshit, I mean, the problem with some of these things is they're half true.
Yeah.
It's like, guns don't kill people, people kill people. That's half true, and it's half infuriating.
Yeah.
And that's what makes for things to be so... It's like, pick yourself up by the bootstraps. There is a validness to that in the sense of, like, hard work does pay off, but you're also neglecting so many other factors.
Yeah.
Like, who your parents are, what year is it, what city is it? Like all these, like, little factors. It's like, I know a lot of, like, real estate tycoons that just so happen to be from, like, Chelsea, Manhattan in the 80s, or like Washington, D.C. in the 80s,
yeah.
where it's like, never forget what city you started in was on a, like an exponential, like, rise, and it had nothing to do with you, and it was chance.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah. show me, like, real estate tycoons from, like, El Paso in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, they're not out there.
Yeah.
Like, Malcolm Gladwell showed that almost every single tech CEO is born in the same month.
Really?
Yeah, because it's outliers. It's all, like, stuff that you have no control over.
There was a book that by Christopher
Great James. Human being. All right, here's a little clip from the new Case Closed Beers Open. When it comes on iTunes, please subscribe, rate it, comment it, do all that good stuff, because we're starting from scratch, and we want this thing to really take off. Because Why Didn't They Laugh is for comedians, people that like the mechanism of comedy. Lawyers write to me a lot, people that aspire to be in politics, people that like public speech, people that like brain engineering, like the science of social, I guess. But it's not, this podcast isn't for everyone. So we're trying to make a podcast that is just entertaining to people.
Closed. Beer's open.
If he smoked weed, I'd know right where he is. But if he did meth, he's gone. Who knows where he is? If he does coke, he cleans like a wild man. Must be meth, because his bike is here.
What? That made no sense at all.
Everyone loved Grizz, especially the boys. He was a local legend and a kind guy with a huge beard. But the boys knew nothing about drugs.
What's coke? Is that a type of beer?
The boys went down to the watering hole to talk to Coop, who was a near expert on almost everything. They needed more information. Time was running out, and they needed to find Grizz.
So Grizz is missing. Do you have any ideas? You've known him for a long time. Where do we look?
Well, you know, Grizz, he gets into the hard stuff. Depending on what he did, you'll find out where he went.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, smokes a bunch of weed, run up in the basement. He does a bunch of blow, starts cleaning all the knickknacks, does the dishes, and, you know, sometimes he gets in the mess, just heads straight for Malone.
He goes to the city of Malone?
Oh, yeah.
But his wife said his bike was in the driveway.
Oh, he doesn't take his bike. He's hoofing it.
With shoes?
No shoes.
Why does he go to Malone?
No one knows why he goes to Malone.
The boys didn't want to admit to Coop that they had no idea what meth was. So they went to a friend who was a professor of chemistry.
Amphetamine, speed.
Right.
It's just like...
So the more you can support that when it comes out, the better. And you can always email me, whydidn'tthelaugh@gmail.com. And when Case Closed Beers Open comes out, you can email us cases that we can crack. As always, please comment, rate, share this podcast. Every bit helps. It's the stuff you guys have written have been very kind. The only real bad reviews this has gotten was during the when I criticized Beyonce. I got a few really nasty emails or nasty comments with a bunch of Queen Bee things, because I guess you never make fun of the Queen Bee. It's exhausting. All right, but I love you guys. Stay hydrated. Peace.